Our second presentation this morning will be co-presented by Michael Marin, MD, a risk management consultant with Milmick, and Tom Gray, Esquire, who is vice president of upstate claims for Donald J. Fager and Associates. Dr. Marin is a 1981 graduate, and I just hit the, there we go. Dr. Marin is a 1981 graduate of the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science in the Chicago Medical School in Chicago. He completed his internship and residency in internal medicine at Lenox Hill, being there 1982 to 1984. Following the completion of his residency, Dr. Marin began a 25-year career as an emergency medicine physician, serving as the medical director of the emergency services and ambulance department of Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City for over 20 years. Dr. Marin has achieved board certification in internal medicine and emergency medicine, and he's currently serving as medical director for Permise Health, a national healthcare company. Dr. Marin is a member of the Peer Review Committee and Claims Committee of Medical Liability and a medical liability risk management consultant. He's reviewed over 700 medical malpractice cases and has been a frequent participant in many risk management educational programs with a focus on high liability exposure cases involving diagnostic errors in the emergency department. Tom Gray is a 1997 graduate of Albany Law School, admitted to practice in New York State and federal courts. Tom began his career representing defendants in civil litigation and ultimately complex civil litigation, including labor law, products liability, and medical malpractice. He's represented his clients through trial to verdict and argued in the appellate division. In 2003, Tom joined the law firm, which is now Fager, Amsler, and Keller, opening the Latham office to expand legal services to Milmick and its insureds. While at Fager, Amsler, and Keller, he represented physicians, dentists, hospitals, and other healthcare providers in medical malpractice and professional licensing matters, and provided legal counsel on risk management and health law issues. Tom's role in the Milmick organization changed in 2014 when he joined Donald J. Fager and Associates as vice president, upstate claims, overseeing the claims operation in the Latham office. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Marin and Tom Gray as they discuss managing diagnostic errors in the emergency department, a claims and risk management perspective. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Martin. Good morning. Am I being heard in the back of the room? Thank you. Diagnostic errors are a well-recognized problem, and in preparing for a discussion like this here today, there's plenty of materials. Getting to my office this past Tuesday morning and turning on the computer, NBC.com came up, which it always does, and I was greeted with a headline, "Getting it wrong. Everyone suffers an incorrect or late diagnosis." It's attention-catching, isn't it? Everyone suffers an incorrect or late diagnosis. Excuse me a second. So it did catch my attention, and I read the article. And this article concluded, or this study, which coincided with this article, concluded that at least 5% of U.S. adults who seek outpatient care each year experience a diagnostic error. And post-mortem exams suggest diagnostic errors contribute to 10% of patient deaths. Now, if that's not enough, they went on with an example to illustrate their point. And their point was to promote this public release of a study by the National Academy of Medicine, reinforcing the need to improve diagnostic medicine. The example they gave of a failure in diagnostic medicine was a young girl, an infant, as a matter of fact, who there was a missed diagnosis of jaundice, which led to severe cerebral palsy. Obviously, a highly sympathetic case. Beyond that, and you probably can't see this, but this is the picture from the NBC.com article. her father holding her. Her father expired some time later after a 6-month delay in diagnosis of a sarcoma in his neck. Beyond this article, I got home, turned on the news, and found Lester Holt talking about this also. So this is in the public's mind now, these diagnostic errors. And it's been in the mind of medical journals and studies for a long, long time. Milnick is and has been a longstanding member of the PIAA, Physicians Insurance Association of America. It's a trade organization that is comprised of medical insurers. And since 1985, the PIAA has collected claims data from all of the insurers, from each of the insurers. And diagnostic errors is one area in which the PIAA is focused in order, with an eye towards patient care, enhanced patient care, and better risk management, to define diagnostic errors, what causes them, what's prevalent in those. And as always with such studies, it yields a great volume of statistics. Now a little about the PIAA. The PIAA is a wonderful database for these studies. It's a large national organization. It insures 2/3 private practicing physicians, somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 hospitals, and for all healthcare practitioners, more than 1 million of them. So the data collected by this organization is significant. Now, according to the PIAA data, acknowledging diagnostic errors is a problem. It concludes that it's a problem across all specialties and then goes on to prioritize these specialties, as illustrated by this slide: radiology errors, internal medicine errors, family practice errors, and then what we're here to talk about for this section, emergency medicine. So should we take this diagnostic error issue seriously from an insurer point of view? Patient care, obviously, insurer point of view, yes. 3,651 closed claims from a 10-year study, more than $250 million in indemnity payment, and average indemnity of over $300,000. Diagnostic errors in the ED are the first issue of the more prevalent cases that we see in claims. Primary issue in 46% of claims involving emergency medicine. The other issues combined don't come to 46%. So diagnostic errors in the emergency department is obviously a significant issue. Coming in a list following diagnostic errors, we have improper performance of a procedure, failure to supervise, failure to perform a procedure, delay in performing a procedure, medication errors, failure or delay in making a referral, and failure or delay to admit. All of those follow diagnostic errors in the ED. From an insurer point of view, diagnostic errors in the ED are the most expensive of those cases we see in the emergency department. Almost $100 million in indemnity payments, encompassing 64% of total indemnity paid, and 31 of the cases, or 31% of the cases, paid to close, the average being 27%. With an average indemnity, in other words, paid out per case that we pay on, of almost $382,000. Okay. Among these studies, Johns Hopkins also weighed in on this. And their information, or their data, is consistent, I'd like to say, with MLM's data, which is also consistent with the PIAA data. The amount of money paid out on these cases, the percentage of cases settled, the percentage of cases in which diagnostic error is a prevalent factor, matches up in each of these studies that I viewed in preparation for this presentation. huge, huge study basis, 340,000 paid claims analyzed over 25 years. Leading type of claims paid in these cases. Now, this study went a little deeper into the issue of inpatient versus outpatient, and outpatient cases outweighed those of inpatient, but inpatient were more likely to be fatal. And along with or consistent with the Johns Hopkins study was JAMA article in which JAMA estimates some 40 to 80,000 hospital deaths per year are related to diagnostic errors. And on that note, Dr. Marin's going to flesh out some details on some of these cases and points that go along with diagnostic errors. Thanks, Doc.
All right, good morning. I just want to thank MLMIC for inviting me to participate in this program. I very much enjoy teaching, and although I am not in the emergency department currently, I feel like it's in my DNA, and I remain an emergency department physician forever. And even in my clinical practice, where I still interact with patients, it's still my headset to approach this as an emergency department patient, and the challenges are numerous, right? We've never met these patients before, getting history. You have this one opportunity to sort of do the right thing. And of course, when I teach this, I explain to physicians that here we are expected to be 100% correct 100% of the time, and even if you are, you're still open for a malpractice case. So with that challenge, let's sort of dissect away emergency department visits and see where we can make a difference. And although maybe my comments are more directed towards emergency department physicians and ER directors, I would expect risk managers to hopefully write down a few things and go back to your hospital and say to your ER director, how do we do this here, okay? So each component of an emergency department visit, of course, there's history, there's physical exam, laboratory test, radiology tests, interpretation of these results, and a disposition, either admission or discharge. And I want to focus in on physical examination initially, because I feel this is a component of most emergency department visits that is not given enough attention. And specific to physicals, I want to also address issues taking on John's comments about the electronic medical record, maybe the good and bad. Now, my first day in reviewing charts for MLMIC, I was explained if it's on the chart, it's there and it was done. So with that in mind, in almost every electronic chart, there is a box that anyone can check that says, I have reviewed the triage assessment. I have reviewed the nursing assessment. I have reviewed the vital signs. Well, in my mind, if you've checked that box, that means you've reviewed it. And I would strongly urge, you know, that the physicians or PAs or nurses, whoever, really actually take the time to read it through. Because if you do have a patient, a 75-year-old female who's on Coumadin, who had a head injury, and you discharge that patient without a non-contrast CT, saying, well, I didn't know they were on Coumadin, that's just no excuse. So take the time, and I would also suggest in your history that you address that pertinent piece. Maybe the current medications, the allergies. Again, as you write up this chart after the patient's visit, make that specific comment because then it's very obvious that you are on top of it. But let's take a look at the physical exams that show up in electronic medical records. Of course, these are supposed to be time-saving events. You click a button, an exam pops up. How often does each component of that physical exam actually take place? And this is an exam that accompanied a patient I'll get to in a sec, but I would sort of call this exam more of a brief exam, listing out systems, a couple of specific physical exam points, right? But let's take a look at this case. This is a case of a 55-year-old male presented to an emergency department complaining of chest pain, radiation. He had a very significant past medical history. Everything sounds like coronary artery disease to the ER physician. He does an electrocardiogram. The cardiogram has some minor ST segment elevations in 3 and F. He calls the cath lab, says, I have an acute MI. The patient is emergently transported to the cath lab. The invasive cardiologist begins the procedure, puts the dye in, and the patient has an abdominal aortic aneurysm. The physician, the cardiologist, calls the vascular surgeon, continues with his piece, does see that there is a right coronary artery, begins to stent the right coronary artery, and of course the aneurysm ruptures, the patient can't be resuscitated, and the patient dies. Milmick represented the ER physician. And I could certainly, if I put myself in his place, based upon the information that he had, say, yes, you did the right decision. And I went back to his physical exam. And in the physical exam, specific to his abdominal exam, right? Oops. Although he does not specifically say the absence of an abdominal pulsatile mass, this is a benign abdominal exam in my mind, and I felt we could easily defend the ER physician. Let's take a look at another kind of physical exam that absolutely pops up. And I would say this is more of a comprehensive exam. Here again, system by system, but much more detail into each and every one of these systems. And as I go through it, again, it continues with excellent detail, system by system, right? And let's take a look at the case that this kind of exam accompanied. And this is the case of a 30 or 28-year-old female who presented with right ear trauma. Now, I reviewed this case, and I have to say to myself, did this physician actually examine the breast, the rectal, and the GYN on this particular patient? And of course, I'm going to say, impossible. Nobody would do that. You know, the ER staff, they do directed or, you know, very specific physical exam findings. So my message here is be very familiar with what your electronic medical record produces. They generally are always written as a normal or negative exam. And if there is a specific issue, like in this case, an ENT exam, go back into the ENT exam and give more detail. Really tells the reviewer, and I imagine the defense attorney, that you really did perform that exam. And as I heard from one defense attorney in a case where I was a witness, he referred to this sort of as the boat theory, that the more holes you can punch in the boat, the more likely it's going to sink. And whether the plaintiff can actually produce enough evidence to say malpractice or not malpractice, as long as he punches holes in what you did, the jury is going to understand that. So be very cognizant of what comes up in that record. Let's talk about communications issues in the emergency department. And of course, think of all different people that are going to touch that patient: the triage nurse, the district nurse, the head nurse, the doctor, the patient. To the communication issues are so numerous. How do you keep it all straight in an environment that you're probably, as the ER physician, following 5, 10, 15 other patients at any one particular time? And I think sometimes what happens is that the ER physician focuses in on some piece, because they can't keep everything straight. So they focus in on some piece about that particular patient. And let me tell you this case. This is a 28-year-old male who presented to an emergency department, chest pain, shortness of breath, with some mild hemoptysis. And in the evaluation of this patient, I think our ER physician, in this case, yes, they went through a process. They did a chest x-ray, which was read as normal. They did an electrocardiogram, which our ER physician says was terribly abnormal, but could not come to grips, in essence, because she thought this was a 28-year-old male, and how could a 28-year-old male have a significant underlying cardiac problem? And this patient ended up being discharged from the emergency department with no follow-up in place for that cardiogram. And just to finish the story, about 2 weeks later, the patient walks into sort of like an urgent care environment, very similar symptoms. The urgent care physician gets sort of the same history, but certainly nothing about that this patient had been in an emergency department, and nothing that this patient has an abnormal electrocardiogram. She discharges the patient on Zithromax, thinking this is an upper respiratory tract infection or a bronchitis, and about 3 days later, the patient has a cardiac arrest and dies. The underlying medical problem on this patient was critical aortic stenosis, and he had had a lifelong murmur. The electrocardiogram, I'm sure, reflected different findings related to hypertrophy within his EKG, you know, within his heart. And I think the failure here by our ER physician was simply that they could not put together this healthy-looking 28-year-old male and say he had an underlying medical problem. And this is the bias that sometimes does come up. Same sort of issue where you focus in on only one particular aspect, and you don't necessarily, at the end of the visit, contemplate other potential causes for this patient's issues. So this is a case, it's a 45-year-old male who was referred to the emergency department by his private physician that he had seen earlier in the day. And he came in with a febrile illness. The private physician did a CBC, got the results later on in the day. The white count was 33,000 and referred the patient to the emergency department. The triage nurse writes down, referred to the emergency department for the evaluation of fever, leg pain, and an elevated white count. The ER physician sees the patients first, does an evaluation, and I'm going to tell you it was a cursory evaluation, but in his mind, this patient was going to get admitted to the hospital, repeats the CBC, and admits the patient. And the patient had come in at 10 o'clock in the evening. About 2:30 in the morning, the hospitalist comes to the emergency department to see the patient. The repeat white count is now back. It's 31 and a half. Again, does a cursory evaluation and says this patient has a viral illness and discharges the patient at 2:30 in the morning. The patient comes back within 6 to 8 hours. He has a significant necrotizing fasciitis of his left leg, which required multiple surgeries and one complication after another. And I think what happened here is, again, you know, they just didn't put the story together. And the patient said, even in triage, I have leg pain. And it just wasn't really addressed. And a little problem here also, and it didn't come up yet this morning, but I believe the hospitalist went into the chart after the fact and added a leg exam. So it's a tough one. So what are all the issues in that emergency department? Boy, they go on forever. In my own, about over 30% of hospital admissions came in through the emergency department. So it was a very high acuity level. And our biggest issue was the throughput to a hospital bed. But so you have all of these admitted patients in the emergency department, and you have all the new patients coming in. And of course, there's overcrowding, there's understaffing, maybe the access to the appropriate specialist doesn't happen like it happens on television and that ER show. That was always one of my favorite things about that show. I always seem to have the specialist in the back room ready to come out at a moment's notice. That and, of course, and all the sex that was going on, of course, that always took place. But keeping in mind, so I want to talk about, again, I'm making a big emphasis on physical exam. And again, I'm hoping just to come up with a couple of issues that are pertinent for you. But this was the case of an 18-year-old girl, basketball player, came in. She had jammed her finger. The ER physician examines the patient. The patient's complaint was at the proximal interphalangeal joint. It was tender. It was swollen. She does an x-ray. The x-ray is negative, says you have a sprained finger, and discharges the patient. And in her evaluation, she says the finger moves. So what happened, of course, is that the patient may have had a jam at the PIP joint, but the patient had a rupture of her flexor tendon at the DIP joint. So the examination that my finger moves isn't really a complete exam on my part, in my you know, estimation. And I wondered to myself, does that physician actually know how to do that examination? You know, be very nice to, because closed finger injuries, open finger injuries, very common in the emergency department, and missed flexor tendon ruptures or tears, also very common. So what would I love to see? I'd love to see that I did the superficialis flexor tendon and the profundus flexor tendon. And if you don't know how to do that exam, I'm not going to embarrass anybody here, please go home and learn it and make sure everybody in your emergency department knows how to do it, okay? All right. Boy, it's very tough in that emergency department in terms of communication as you reach out to other staff members to help you in the care. And what are those lines of responsibility, boy? It's, you know, what I'd like to make a plea for in this particular slide is that I understand the ER physician wants to admit patients to the hospital, and then he can sign off on the case and he's off to the next patient. And my plea here is for the what's better for that patient. You know, every admission process in each hospital is a little bit different. In some hospitals, the admitting private physician has to come in and see that patient. In other situations, there's an admitting team or a hospitalist. But who is the person actually seeing that patient, you know? And if your patient is ill, right, just simply signing off that case to that next level is not absolutely taking care of that patient. If that patient needs fluids, if that patient needs electrolytes, if that patient needs antibiotics, if that patient needs blood, don't just simply look at this patient in a compartment. You know, there's the ER piece, there's the ICU piece, the CCU piece, the surgical floor piece. I think the big picture here is how best can my hospital take care of that patient and let there be a good flow that's for the patient's benefit in terms of admission. My plea here is about supervision. Most busy emergency departments have an urgent care area, a fast track area, a walk-in area. Every place calls it a little bit different. And usually it's the triage nurse who makes that decision who should be seen in the main ED and who could be seen in your urgent care area. And in most hospital emergency rooms, physician assistants are the care providers in the urgent care area. And very typically, although there's a physician assigned, the physician assistant is treating and discharging patients. And at the end of the shift by both the PA and the physician comes and just blanketly signs 20 charts, 25 charts. I'm going to say I don't believe that is good practice. What kind of things have I seen missed in the urgent care areas? Ankle sprains that are Achilles tendon ruptures. Pharyngitis, that's epiglottitis. Missed flexor tendon injuries. Again, I'm just going to make a big plea on that one. These are all items that are missed. What we did in our emergency department, it was a staffing issue decision on my end, but I assigned a physician assistant and a attending physician to the fast track area. Maybe we expanded the kinds of patients that could be sent there, but the policy, no patient gets discharged until that case is presented to the attending physician, so the physician has the opportunity to see the patient himself. Did I expect that physician to see each and every patient? Sure. In my dream of dreams, sure. But I understand. But at least there was the opportunity to go and review that case and not simply sign off on cases at the end of the day. Keep in mind, patients in general are very poor historians. Obviously, the older patients are the worst historians. So is there opportunity to get history from anyone else? That certainly should be part of the process. Certainly, I'm a big fan of paramedics and EMTs. I think they are extremely reliable until what they saw at the scene. That should be part of your history, as well as information from family members, if it's around. And if it's not around, call the private physician. Get the history. That's important, because simply saying, well, I didn't know that, I don't think that's good practice. And in another group of patients that I'll say the more complicated history, I'm just amazed at the number of patients, like those who are status post colonoscopy, for example, or any endoscopy procedure, that come to the emergency department with a potential complication, or those surgery patients that get discharged from a same-day surgery unit, not even in your hospital. Or I've seen patients where after they've had a delivery and discharged from home, now are in the emergency department. And I am absolutely just at times dumbfounded why the ER is not calling that physician who did that procedure, who's responsible for that patient, to discuss the patient. I don't know why we have to sort of work in this vacuum and not use that resource that's available to us, let alone look how difficult it would be to get a history from a you know, an acutely psychiatric patient or a substance abuse. It's just so tough. So use the resources that are available to you. All right? It's an interesting case, and I bring it to your attention because you're going to say to me, it couldn't have happened, right? But this was the story of a 35-year-old male who presented to an emergency department after a syncopal episode. And just to help you work through the case, I'm going to tell you that he had a previous syncopal episode about a week before. He's now in the emergency department, though, awake, alert, and stable vital signs. And our ER physician says, okay, this is syncope. I'm going to put him into either the cardiac syncope or the neurologic syncope, and orders, I would say, the routine workup for this on a cardiac monitor, electrocardiogram, laboratory test, probably did a set of cardiac enzymes, does a non-contrast CT, which was negative, and then sends the patient off for an echocardiogram. In the echocardiogram suite, in the presence of the cardiologist doing the echocardiogram, the patient has a recurrent episode. And there were other symptoms associated with the patient's complaint, but now we know he's being monitored and it's not a cardiac issue. And the cardiologist sends the patient back down to the emergency department, tells the nurse who brought the patient down to tell the emergency department about what just happened. Now, who the nurse told, I don't know, it wasn't any place on the chart. And certainly the ER physician says, well, I never knew about it. And that information never got communicated to anybody who was caring for that patient in the emergency department. To tell you what was going on with this patient, this was absolutely neurologic. He was having vertebral basilar insufficiency, symptoms of headache, nausea, paresthesias, and as he waited for his bed in the emergency department, he fully stroked out and needed to be intubated and did not survive the hospitalization. So they had an opportunity here to intervene. It might have been a little difficult. They had to be in the right place at the right time, but this information just never got across. So what is the communication when you send your patient out of the emergency department? How do they get that information back? How quickly do they get it back? Oh, yeah. So Tom is now going to present some bigger cases, which we hope sort of illustrate some of these points, and I'll continue with the analysis.
Thanks, Doc. Before we get there, we're going to talk a little bit about plaintiff and defense perspective on these failure to diagnose cases. In most of these medical malpractice cases, we end up with what we call the battle of the experts, and probably pretty familiar with those. Our experts are more credible than their experts or not. This is how the jury makes the decision. In my opinion, failure to diagnose cases rely a lot more heavily on the testimony of the defendant practitioner. And it's through a differential diagnosis progression of questions that this is done. Typically in these cases, you'll see the doctor asked under oath what their diagnosis was in the given case, and that's in the record, and they'll give that answer. Then they'll be asked if they reviewed the subsequent treating records in preparation for their testimony. Typically that's the case, and they have. So that's followed with the question, doctor, do you know what the ultimate diagnosis was in this case? Well, yes, I do, and what was it? Well, it was this. Doctor, was that the diagnosis that you rendered upon your analysis of this patient's condition? No, it is not. Okay. Now, doctor, what is the term differential diagnosis? Are you familiar with that term? Well, yes, I am. And what is that? That is the process through which we address the more dangerous, the more serious ailment or illness consistent with the presenting symptoms and go through a progression toward the less worrisome but more common explanations for the system, for the symptoms. Well, doctor, did you conduct a differential diagnosis in your analysis of this patient's complaints? Well, yes, I did. I always do. Doctor, was the ultimate diagnosis, not your diagnosis, was the ultimate diagnosis within your list of differential diagnoses? Now, the doctor here is at a crossroads. That's a yes or no question. And if the answer to that question is no, I didn't consider that diagnosis, it's a hard hurdle to overcome for that physician in defending the case. If the doctor answers yes, I did consider that diagnosis, the doctor will usually be presented with their chart from their care and treatment and asked to show within that chart where they went through the diagnostic process to rule out that ultimate diagnosis. In the cases we see at MLMIC and are part of these studies, the misdiagnosis, more often than not, is the more serious, the more threatening, life-threatening of diagnoses. So any diagnostic process the physician went through toward ruling that out should be charted. And if that's not supportable in the chart, these are very difficult cases to defend. Now, from the defense perspective, we like a jury that's sophisticated enough to understand the difference between getting it wrong and deviating from the standard of care. And that's something I believe is handled by our counsel on voir dire primarily. Can we select jurors that will make that distinction? We know the doctor got it wrong. We usually can't defend that the doctor got it wrong in these diagnostic cases. The plaintiff holds the burden to prove a deviation from the standard of care. If the doctor, if the PA, if the practitioner went through the appropriate progression of diagnostics to get toward the outcome they reached, and that outcome is reasonably supported by the medicine, and we have an expert that will come in and say so, the fact that the diagnosis is wrong does not entitle the plaintiff to verdict. That is a fair defense on the standard of care medicine. As Dr. Marin said, we have a couple of cases that came out of our office, and we'll get into those a little bit. This case started on a nice June evening where the person in question was out for a drive, and a deer jumped in front of their car. Many of us have probably been there. This guy was paying attention, was quick enough to avoid the deer. In fact, he didn't hit anything. He jammed on his brakes, he swerved violently, he missed the deer. Well, when he woke up the next day, he was experiencing some back pain. So he went to his local ED. He gave the history of the deer in the road, his history of hypertension, tobacco use, and chronic back pain. The PA in the emergency department took some x-rays, low back, pelvis x-rays, and found them, read them as negative. Patient was given pain medication and discharged. Okay. 4 days later, the patient's still experiencing back pain, significant enough that he presents to a different ED, complaining of pain and now spasms. That PA diagnoses back strain. Aware of the prior ED visit and that diagnosis, back strain discharged with more pain medication. Same day, patient's wife called back. My husband is still in a lot of pain. The recipient of the phone call at the ED recommended an MRI. That ED didn't have MRI capabilities, recommended that the patient go to another facility to get that MRI. Later that day, to yet another ED by ambulance, excruciating pain, hip, back, spasms. The PA at that facility told the patient that they didn't meet the criteria for an MRI and offered that patient another x-ray. That patient took the position that I've already had an x-ray. The x-ray was negative. I don't see any value in that. No, thank you. Again, back slash hip pain, Toradol, pain med, patient discharged. 2 days later, 6 days after the initial visit, I think there's probably people in the audience have an idea where this is going here. Pain worsened to ED by ambulance. He finally gets a CT scan, 9.2 centimeter by 7, abdominal aortic aneurysm. He was transferred for repair and fortunately survived. Now, Dr. Marin's going to be good enough to discuss some of the risk management issues related to this case.
So very dramatic case, right? And I think you could look at it all together, or you could sort of individually look at each one of those emergency department visits. And I don't know how many physicians are in the audience, but when I first looked at this case, and although I did not have access to the actual emergency department charts, I wondered to myself on that first emergency department visit, would I have even done x-rays? You know, the patient sounds like he's got a musculoskeletal issue. If I was comfortable with my neurologic exam, with my physical exam, and he has no bony tenderness, would I have actually even done x-rays myself? So that was first of my thought process. Some of the other details of these other visits, though, I think are a little bit more telling. When the patient went to the emergency department for the second time, he did come in by ambulance. He came at 5:21 in the morning, severe back pain. The ER physician, I'm sorry, the PA does an examination. It's not very well detailed, treats the patient with Demerol. Of course, the patient feels better and discharges the patient. 6 hours later is when the patient again goes by ambulance now to the third emergency department. So again, there, the examination's slightly better, but not thorough. And I'm gonna harp again on that, the need for very good, thorough physical exam. And I think the fault here is, of course, not thinking of any other diagnosis but musculoskeletal discomfort, right? If that's what the physical exam shows. And of course, no one along the line ever called the first hospital to see if the report on the x-rays was positive or negative. They just listened to the patient, said, I was told they were normal. But here, of course, you'd have to have your thinking cap on. In terms of differential diagnoses, you're not necessarily going to think of an abdominal aortic aneurysm in every 55-year-old patient who comes through the door, even though they have a history of hypertension and smoking and puts them at risk for it. But it certainly should be thought, you know, in your thought process. And I think about day two or day three of medical school, they teach, well, if you hear hoofbeats, don't think zebra. But of course, if you never think of zebra, you'll never make a diagnosis outside of the routine. So you really have to have a clinical suspicion. And when a patient returns to an emergency department for the second time, for the third time, it has to raise your concern that there's something more than musculoskeletal problem. And at no point did any of the three visits did they ever ask for any other consultation to help them in this process. So, in general, boy, this is just a poorly managed case. Information, lack of communication, and I'm going to say lack of good, thorough physical exam, as well as a differential. What should bring this patient back to an emergency department for the third time? You must be concerned about that. Who comes to an emergency department at 5 o'clock in the morning? Boy, you know, that person alone is telling you, there's something wrong with me, I need your help. So it's an impossible case to defend, in my opinion. Let's go to case number two, which is really kind of interesting too.
Dr. Marin is correct, kind of an impossible case to defend. We did end up settling that case. On to case study two, gentleman of a similar age comes to our ED. He's got fever and chills for about 6 hours, common presentation. He's got a history of chronic interstitial cystitis, and at 18 years old had his spleen removed. His flu vaccine is not current. Vitals are taken. He's got a temperature of 101, oximetry 98%, respiratory rate 22, pulse 103, and blood pressure 138 over 87. And after an hour after he arrives, his temperature increases to 104. He's given Tylenol and ibuprofen, and that controls the temperature back down to 100.6, oximetry 92%, heart rate 98. Differential diagnosis, which we discussed a little earlier, on the list is a urinary tract infection, tick-borne illness, and viral syndrome. Now, as to the tick-borne illness, I should tell you that it's December in the Northeast, and there's no indication that this patient has traveled outside of the Northeast. Toward evaluating the patient, a CBC, comprehensive medical profile, urinalysis culture, and studies for these tick-borne illnesses. Treat him for the tick-borne illnesses, ibuprofen, and Tylenol. And he's discharged. 10 hours later, by ambulance, abdominal pain, shortness of breath, chest pain. Patient was septic and expired. Doctor.
All right, so how do I go backwards? How do I go backwards?
Which? How far back?
To the first one. No. Go.
Good there?
Yeah. All right. So let's say you're the physician coming to see this patient. This is the information that you have in front of you as you walk into the room to see the patient. And for anyone who's gone through the emergency medicine certification piece, you know there's a written exam and an oral exam. And the oral exam, they teach you, what do I see when I walk into the room? So you get a sense of how sick or not sick the patient is. But take a look at those vital signs, right? Elevated temperature, elevated respiratory rate, elevated pulse. Anyone who's familiar with an entity called the systemic response syndrome, right? This patient, along with these vital signs and has an elevated white count, there's a four, what should we say, characteristics of this patient likely being septic from step one. If you have two of the four, it's a 50%. Our patient here had all four, right? The elevated temperature, the elevated respiratory rate, the elevated pulse, and the white count was 14,900. So immediately, when I look at this patient, I know he's really sick. Whether I appreciated the fact that he had a spleen or didn't have a spleen should just add to my potential differential diagnosis for the problem with this likely septic patient, right? Also keep an eye on that pulse oximetry. Although it's not one of the characteristics, it's 98%. So now as our physician works through the case, he does his urinalysis. There's certainly nothing on the urinalysis that is likely to show infection. The urine culture, which of course wasn't available when the patient was in the emergency department, was negative. That white blood cell count, as I said to you, was 14,900. It was 78 polys. It was 14% bands, and it was 1% lymphocytes. So could this be a viral syndrome? Hardly, right? Could this be a tick-borne illness? Again, the time of year sounds unlikely. Is there a tick-borne illness that presents with a fever of 104 and no other symptoms? Also pretty unlikely. So although our doctor thought about a differential diagnosis, he certainly didn't put the case together. And not only, of course, was this patient septic, but the organisms that he was septic from makes him susceptible because he does not have the spleen. And of course, when he presented the second time to the emergency department, now truly septic, his blood cultures grew out strep pneumonia. Did the patient survive? No. Yeah. So at that point, there's about a 90% chance that the patient will not survive. If you had this patient during that first emergency department visit, it's about 50 to 70% that patient will survive. So, you know, you can't certainly argue that he was going to die anyway, right? But you can certainly say, had you made the right interpretation and intervened with fluids, broad spectrum antibiotics, and continuous reassessment, right? And what I want to tell you also, and I'm a big believer of, you know, pre-discharge vital signs, that although his temperature came down from the 104 to like 100.4, the heart rate came down to about 98, the respiratory rate came down to about 16, but his pulse oximetry, which was 98% on admission, dropped to 92% at time of discharge. So putting this case together, right, there is certainly so many opportunities for someone to have said, boy, this patient is really sick, he can't go home. And I just want to sort of continue from here. He was treated with doxycycline, but again, not for an appropriate. So is it important to document a differential diagnosis? I think the important piece at the end of each emergency department visit is put the visit together. What were the patient's symptoms? This is my plan, and this is why it's my plan. A lot of electronic medical records allow you to choose multiple different things because it also lends you to then the discharge instructions. So this patient would have gone home with the discharge instructions for Lyme disease, for urinary tract infection, if you had clicked all those buttons. So it, again, it's, I think it's more important to put the patient together. And I know there's a rush, and I know there's a rush to see that patient. And for some reason, there's a rush to get that patient out of the emergency department to make room for the next one. But you need to pause. You need to put the case together. And I'm not saying for each and every single patient, but for those patients that have a more acute illness, you should take the time and really do that. And now I'm going to make my big push for vital signs. Obviously, at time of admission to the emergency department, every patient should have a full set of vital signs. And I'm going to tell you what the electronic medical record does do is that you can make these demand fields, so you don't have to, you cannot continue unless there's a full set of vital signs. And I would make my bigger plea to say at time of discharge, there should be a second set of vital signs. And if at any time during this patient's visit to the emergency department, a vital sign is abnormal, it should be addressed. And at time of discharge, what is it now, whether it's the temperature is now down or the pulse rate is now down. That would indicate that the patient potentially is more stable for discharge than if he has a dropping pulse oximetry, right? Doesn't make any sense. Oops. So let's talk about radiology, which is a huge piece in every single emergency department. I'm going to tell you this is a case that happened in my emergency department years ago, and we changed our practice significantly because of this case. It was a very simple 55-year-old female, came in complaining of right upper quadrant pain. The examination was sort of plus minus. The ER physician sends the patient to radiology for a sonogram of the right upper quadrant. Patient comes back down to the ER. The ER physician calls upstairs to his friend, the radiologist. How was the sonogram? Sonogram's normal. Great. You can go home. Right? About a year later, I hear from the patient's private physician, listen, Mrs. So-and-so was in your emergency department a year ago. I just want to tell you we were doing a workup on her, and lo and behold, she's got a right kidney mass. And when I pulled the sonogram for when she was in the emergency department from a year ago, absolutely, there was a right kidney mass. Did that information ever get to the emergency department? No. And there are case after case after case of a failure of that communication. And again, since so many of our patients do get a radiology procedure, you need a process in place. And not only a process for this, but I'll take it another step forward. You know, and the policy should read something like to the effect that if you find an emergent medical problem on any kind of radiology test, you must call the emergency department and let them know, because you don't know from the radiologist's point of view, whether we saw it or didn't see it. So that was step one. If you see a potential emergent problem, like my patient with the sonogram, and it's unrelated to why the test was done, you must call the emergency department and tell them. Now, it's such a difficult process because many hospitals, they have a radiologist on for a certain period of time, then they're covered by some nighthawk overnight, and then the next radiologist comes on, and they say, well, you know, I can't call the emergency department 20 times a day. And of course, the person who may have ordered the test isn't even in the emergency department at that time. They've now gone home and may not come back for a week, for all I know, right? So what was the process we put in place so that we wouldn't miss or potentially not miss? So we divided our patients into admitted versus discharged. Admitted patients would be the responsibility to follow up on the x-ray result or the final x-ray result. So the admitting physician would have that responsibility. For any patient that was treated and released in the emergency department, though, we had a system where the final report would print out on a printer in the emergency department office. And usually me, I would have to read through each and every one of those final reports. It was a lot of work, but that was the step that we put in place. I would tell you, if there are ER directors out here, we certainly use this as a quality assurance or, you know, exercise. How well do your physicians actually read chest x-rays? How well do they read long bone films? So you could use it to your advantage. of interest. I'm going to tell you what do emergency department physicians, at least in my emergency department, miss all the time on chest x-rays. Anybody? Pulmonary nodules. We just never see them, right? But in the world of pulmonary nodules, some are benign, some are malignant. They need follow-up care. And if there was a one present, we had to go through the process of notifying the patient, notifying the private doctor, sending the report, and creating all this documentation, at least on our end. I'm going to say the same true with radiology should be lab. What is your policy? What are the critical laboratory test results that you need a call from the lab, and in what period of time? And create this with your lab director. So again, there's no lack of communication, and that potassium of 8.5 doesn't come back 5 hours later. The electronic chart allows you to monitor these sort of things, and you can, I'm seeing most EMRs, you can generate reports, and you could see what the turnarounds are, and you can sort of label these critical results and test your process. All right, so in my case, what I want to sort of discuss here, you know, that young 28-year-old with the abnormal electrocardiogram, how do you ensure that at time of discharge, that patient's going to get the appropriate follow-up care and know why they need that follow-up care? So there's nothing in the discharge instructions on our case, that 28-year-old, that your electrocardiogram is abnormal. I'm telling you that cardiogram is abnormal and you need to see a cardiologist. So it's very important that you have this discussion, all right, and not just simply use those pre-printed discharge instructions that appear, you know, in your electronic record. All right, this was a very tough case. But again, this comes down to the discharge instructions. This was the story. It's a 16-year-old male was woken from sleep at 4:30 in the morning, complaining of severe right scrotal pain, nausea. He vomited several times, woke up his parents. I think it was the mother who eventually took him to the emergency department. They got there around 7 o'clock, see the ER physician around 7:30. And of course, at that time at 7:30, the patient's now symptom-free. The ER physician does an exam, does a urinalysis, and discharges the patient. What was not clear in the discharge instructions, though, is what the possibilities may be, but more importantly, if you have any future pain of any kind, come back to me emergently or go to another emergency department emergently. And where it got a little even murkier from my standpoint is though the 16-year-old was there with his mom, the mom spoke only Spanish, so the instructions were given only to the 16-year-old and not, this patient was not an emancipated minor, not to the parent. So the discharge instructions really care was the problem. And of course, our patient goes home, our patient experiences additional pain. It made it a little bit more difficult because the day of his first emergency department visit was December 24th. And December 25th, he's having pain all day long, does not want to interrupt the family celebration, I'm guessing, and doesn't go to another emergency department until December 26, now 36 hours into this painful syndrome. And of course, he has a testicular torsion and loses that particular testicle. And I think the entity which he initially presented was intermittent testicular torsion. And the miss here was not necessarily the emergent need to see a urologist, but the need to return to the emergency department if you have any additional pain. So there's a lot of great cases. I'm sure there are cases in your own emergency department. How does that information on how to handle that case, how does it get to all of the staff members in that emergency department? Do you have staff meetings? Do you have case reviews? How does that information take place? And what do you do in your system changes to prevent that problem or issue from happening a second time? And that, of course, I would put on the responsibility of the ER director. They must challenge their staff members to be abreast, be knowledgeable, and understand the patients that come to your emergency department. I mean, I could tell you in a percentage, if I saw 130 patients a day at that ER at Lenox Hill, I could break you out the percentages day after day after day. Who's cardiac? How many pulmonary? How many abdominal pains? We don't know who they're going to be, of course, but you know exactly who's coming in. So you don't necessarily have to prepare for the thing that happens to you once in a lifetime. Prepare for the patients that come to your emergency department. We used a lot of order sets, and again, a positive push for electronic medical record are to create order sets. And we had order sets for cardiac, order sets for fever, for GYN, for abdominal pain. We probably had about a dozen of them. And what primarily it does, it standardizes the care in your emergency department so that every patient may get over-tested, and that would be the argument, but less likely you're going to slip through that door. You know, our patient that we were provided, you know, that fever of 104 patient, never had a blood culture in that emergency department on their first visit. That should be the routine. And that's what an order set can do for you. And not only, of course, are the nurses familiar with the order sets, as well as the physicians and the physician assistants. Always like to talk about stroke, because stroke cases come up all the time. And although you certainly can go home and practice your stroke code, stroke team, again, each emergency department calls it something different. But how do you protect yourself as the physician or the emergency department for patients with stroke? Because we know that, again, the patient may come in, the patient may get TPA, they may not get TPA, and if they do or they don't, there can be a malpractice case. Why didn't this patient get TPA? Not just those patients who get TPA and have a complication from it. So the only way, in my mind, to sort of standardize your care and standardize how your emergency department approaches stroke, of course, is in your policy. And if your policy says if you have an NIH score of 3, you're not a candidate for TPA, and that's what should be written in the chart. What if you have a contraindication to TPA? This patient is not a TPA candidate because XYZ. Or this patient is a candidate for TPA, and I have discussed the risks and benefits, and all patients and their family members are aware of what they may be. So you must have a protocol and certainly be familiar with what your protocol is. What kind of cases should be reviewed in your emergency department? You know, we talked about cases already, that poor gentleman with the abdominal aortic aneurysm who had 3 emergency department visits in a short time. I would say any repeat emergency department visit, although the slide says 72 hours, it depends upon the patient and the patient's medical problem. But any repeat emergency department, any death in your emergency department should be evaluated. Certainly many of the patients in our emergency department presented in a cardiac arrest, gives us the opportunity to follow through on the protocols where they followed. But every once in a while, there's a very unusual patient, and it behooves us to then spread that information out to the rest of the emergency department. And sure, if there is an error, and we would hope that you have that kind of environment, that someone is willing to tell you about it, but that should certainly be the primary focus, that your entire emergency department team is there to improve the care in any way, shape, or form. And that hopefully is the buy-in on everybody in that emergency department. The next big piece I just want to address briefly is what happens when a physician goes off shift and signs out to the next physician. And here the opportunity, again, is very difficult. How many times does an ER physician say, you know, check the CAT scan, if it's normal, send them home? Well, what does that mean to me as the physician now coming on and assuming that responsibility? First and foremost, I would say that there should be a physical round. You should go from patient to patient, not a sheet of paper that says, these are my patients, they're now yours. So the coming on physician can put a name to a face. If there is a specific issue that's addressing that patient that came in, again, let's say the patient with abdominal pain, that's now going to be my responsibility. At the time that I'm now taking on that patient, I should go and see that patient, I should examine the abdomen, and I should put my findings in the chart itself. less likely things are going to fall through the crack. Oops, jumped the gun. And that's it for me. Okay, thank you very much.